From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Aaron Swartz and free speech on the Internet. Hello again, I'm Aaron Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Last week, a celebrated internet genius committed suicide, having written about the ravages of acute depression. Aaron Swartz also faced federal charges and possible decades in prison. Some supporters say his indictment could have helped cause his death. He was accused of wire fraud and unlawfully obtaining information in the course of crusading for internet freedom. Do 20-year-old restrictions infringe on a human right made possible by a rapidly changing technology? On Reporter's Notebook later on, new gun control measures in the state of New York. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To The Point. The suicide of a crusader for internet freedom has cast new light on old laws regulating a changing technology. We'll hear about the late Aaron Swartz, his contributions to the internet, and his indictment for federal crimes. On Reporter's Notebook, New York is the first state to increase gun control in the aftermath of the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. First, this news update. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says the U.S. will provide assistance to France against rebels in the vast African desert country of Mali. There has been concern about creating another conflict between Western nations and Muslim extremists, but Panetta says the role of al-Qaeda has forced America to get involved. John Campbell is senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Now, let's talk first about France. So why is it involved, I take it, with airstrikes and troops on the ground?
Three reasons. First, France is the former colonial power and is the European state with the largest interest in Mali. Secondly, France has military assets in West Africa, although not in Mali itself. But there are military assets in West Africa that it could draw on quickly. And then finally, there are at least 3,000 French nationals who live in Bamako. So France is the European country that is the principal actor in Mali.
There was an effort to get African troops into Mali to resist this situation. Why has that failed and left France, caused France to take this action?
It's premature to say that it has failed. It obviously is taking longer than many people would like. This was an effort by the economic community of West African states to put together a multi-African intervention force, which, by the way, has been authorized by the UN Security Council. Putting such a force together, training it and equipping it and financing it takes some time. It had been anticipated that the force would be ready to move as early as September.
Tell us about what's actually going on the ground in Mali. How long has it been going on? And what does it mean to say, as the Secretary of Defense has, that it's linked to al-Qaeda?
There has been a low-level insurrection in northern Mali for a very long time. Northern Mali has regarded itself as marginalized. Its principal minority, the Tuaregs, believe that they have not been accorded the position in the Malian state to which they are entitled. This low-level insurrection bloomed in the aftermath of the fall of Gaddafi, when Libyan weapons flowed south, but so too did some of Gaddafi's mercenaries. The mercenaries plus the weapons plus the indigenous insurrection fairly quickly overwhelmed the local Malian forces. Once, however, the insurrectionists established themselves in northern Mali, Those that merely wanted a separate state were rapidly outmaneuvered by those often called Arabs, and including the radical Islamists. They outmaneuvered the separatists and established the rather brutal Islamic state that we see today.
And that includes some of the things we saw when the Taliban was running Afghanistan, public executions,
Indeed.
The dismemberment of people for crimes and that sort of thing. What's at stake for the United States?
An American concern has been that in a vast territory like northern Mali, under the influence of radical Islam, that there be plenty of opportunities for the establishment of camps and training facilities for international terrorists. The extent to which this has actually happened remains unclear. It is also unclear what exactly it means to talk about al-Qaeda links. Most of the time, that phrase refers to al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. That is a quasi-criminal group, basically of Algerian origin, that for long has run smuggling routes, particularly narcotics trafficking, through northern Mali. So it's criminal, and yet also has an Islamic dimension to it.
So it's a very complicated situation then. How long does it appear the United States is willing to be involved, and how extensively?
There was a very important point made, I think, by Secretary Panetta when he said the United States is providing assistance to France. France is a NATO ally. France is bound to us by treaty. That would be quite different than supplying assistance directly to the government in Bamako, Mali. I would remind our listeners as well, the government in Bamako itself is the result of a military coup that took place last year.
Okay. Once again, a very complex situation. Hard to know how long the French will be involved, much less how long the United States will very indirectly be involved. John Campbell at the Council on Foreign Relations, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, Aaron Swartz and free speech on the Internet on To the Point.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. At the age of 14, Aaron Swartz was considered an Internet prodigy who developed a code that is still used to deliver changing content to the World Wide Web. Last week, he committed suicide at the age of 26. John Swartz, different spelling, no relation, is former legal and science reporter, now domestic correspondent for The New York Times. John Swartz, good to have you on our program.
Hello there. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you. You knew Aaron Swartz. You covered him as a reporter. Tell us about his career and how it started so very early in his life.
Well, this is a kid who just was so brilliant, such a precocious talent. He, at the age of 14, was making contributions to this kind of software that we see around us every day, all day, RSS, which is a way to grab stuff off the web, have that stuff sent to you as the web is ever changing, as content is ever changing. He made good contributions to the effort to develop what's called RSS. His impact is in things like that, but it's also in the way that he just sort of seemed to run around the country, run around the world, meet people, engage them, and make them want to be smarter, want to do more work. He brought the best out in a lot of people.
So he was an extraordinary person and contributed a lot at a very early age. Could he have taken his knowledge and all that he had accomplished and become very wealthy?
Well, he made a good chunk of money with one of his early ventures. He had started a little company. It got acquired or merged with another company, which became Reddit. Reddit was acquired by Condé Nast, and the creators got quite a payday out of that. But It was the only time he made any money off of his work. He really sort of thought of it, I think, as kind of a very nice accident. It was never his intention to get rich, though clearly he could have.
He became what you describe as a sort of internet folk hero. How'd that happen?
Well, along with his abilities in technology and software, direct application, he felt very strongly about his ideals about open culture and making sure that things that, especially things that were created with public money, like the federal court's documents and research that is created using federal money, that somebody not be allowed to keep that behind a wall and make you pay for it again. He felt strongly that a lot of the copyright issues that that copyright holders were heavy-handed in their protection of their copyrights, and that could lead to censorship. And so, as an activist, he inspired a lot of people to act on those ideals as well.
His actions attracted the attention of the federal government, first in a situation that did not lead to any kind of criminal charges. Describe that, if you will.
Well, the first one was what I wrote about in 2009, which I like to call the Pacer Caper. Pacer is the federal documents, federal court documents. And, you know, if you have a judicial opinion, it's going to show up on Pacer. The briefs show up on Pacer, all the motions. And they're part of the public, they're public documents, but a lot of companies sell them by organizing them. And we have this government program called Pacer, and it is out there, and you can download the documents, and it costs 10 cents a page currently. It's been 7, 8 cents a page. Aaron was one of the people who felt that those are public documents. You shouldn't be able to charge for them. They should be free. And so he and another activist, a fellow named Carl Malamud, Carl was working out a system where if you downloaded a Pacer document, you could very easily pass it along to him, and he would put it into an open access repository of his own. Aaron liked this idea a lot, and so he worked out a system to go to public libraries that had a free subscription through a government program and set up a computer program that would simply start downloading Pacer documents wholesale, and ended up with coming up on 20 million pages worth of documents, maybe a fifth of all the documents on Pacer at the time. And the government shut down the program, and as Carl put it, Carl called Aaron when this happened, and he said, "You need to talk to a lawyer. I need to talk to a lawyer." And then they got very worried. The government investigated but declined to prosecute because ultimately it was hard to see what law might have been violated there.
Okay, what was it that led to his prosecution?
Well, in a similar way, the organization called JSTOR, which puts out scientific and technical documents, research, scholarly articles, also has a lot of stuff that was produced with our money, taxpayer dollars. And again, it galled people like Aaron that JSTOR then charges people for access to those documents. And, of course, the company says, look, we organize it. We put it out there. It costs money to do this. But anyway, this time Aaron got access to free access to the documents and, again, started downloading, coming up on 5 million documents, and did it through entering a utility closet at MIT, setting up a computer with a fake account, working around some of the things that MIT tried to do to stop the process of big downloads. And this led to an arrest and a federal indictment. And that's the cloud he was under when he killed himself. That was with the trial coming up starting on April 1st. Now, it's important to say, Aaron had a history of depression. Aaron had written very movingly about contemplating suicide at low points in his life. It is very, very dangerous to say A caused, fact A or thing A caused suicide. One thing caused it. And there's been a tendency to say that the trial, the impending trial, caused this. In fact, suicide is its own thing. Having said all of that, having an enormously expensive legal defense in front of you isn't going to help.
And he was charged with crimes that could have led to his imprisonment for something like 35 years and $1 million in fines.
Right, exactly. 35 years was the maximum. And while anybody will tell you that you end up with almost certainly less than the maximum is what the prosecutors put out in their press releases. It's what gets talked about, and it's something that you cannot ignore. So all of this is going to weigh pretty heavily on you. And there were attempts to come to plea bargains and other ways to reduce this, but it didn't seem to be going anywhere in the last few weeks, I guess.
John Schwartz, reporter for the New York Times, knew and wrote about Aaron Schwartz, the genius computer programmer who is now the victim of suicide. Susan Crawford is a professor at the Cardozo School of Law in New York. She served in the Obama administration as a technical advisor on internet matters. She's author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Susan Crawford, good to have you on our program.
Great to be here.
Do you think, as many of Aaron Schwartz's friends and supporters have said, that this was a prosecutorial overreach? Did the U.S. attorney in the case charge him with much more serious crimes and threaten more serious sentences than were deserved?
Well, Aaron was a very young 26. He was almost like a boy himself. I think that perhaps he should have been treated as a juvenile. I'm almost kidding about this, but not quite. It does seem as if this was a pretty big brick to throw at what was a large piece of downloading, but not one that ultimately harmed anybody. I think Aaron would have done well with community service, something to which he was already dedicated in an online fashion. He really saw open source software and open networks as instrumental in eliminating corruption and unfairness in society, and worked on lots of issues far beyond information policy. So I'm not a prosecutor. I've never practiced criminal law. It does seem to a lot of people commenting on this case that he was facing a much more severe punishment than his crime would trigger.
Back to the issue of whether anybody was harmed, JSTOR, which was the repository for these scholarly articles, produced at taxpayer expense by academics who weren't actually paid for them, then collected by JSTOR and sold, didn't advocate that he be prosecuted. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And JSTOR thinks of itself as an academic repository. It's a tremendously valuable collection of articles for anybody doing research. And many of the people behind that JSTOR paywall, the authors themselves, really want their ideas to be spread more widely, not to be constrained. They're much more interested in the spread of ideas than payment. So JSTOR took the position that the prosecution was the wrong idea. Evidently, we've been reading that a plea bargain attempt broke down at the end about a week before Aaron killed himself. And it was just a tragic state of affairs. But I agree with John Schwartz that we can't draw a causal connection between, a necessary causal connection between what was going on with that case and the fragile psyche of this brilliant young man.
Obviously, depression is an extraordinarily difficult thing to deal with, as has been indicated. He wrote about it himself, and that may be simply another issue. The question then becomes, why did the government come down on him so hard? Orrin Kerr is professor of law at the George Washington School of Law. He's author of Computer Crime Law. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Was this overzealous prosecution by the U.S. attorney, which has been charged by many of Schwartz's supporters, who have said that this was obscene in the excessiveness of it?
I think reasonable people can disagree on that question. We have to realize, first of all, that the 35-year figure that is tossed around in press releases has nothing to do with the actual punishment that that Schwartz would have faced. So the plea bargain deal that the government offered near the end, about a week before Schwartz committed suicide, was, I think, for 6 months in prison. If he had gone to trial, maybe he would have, if convicted, faced and maybe 2 years in jail. That's just a rough estimate. It would have been up to the discretion of the trial judge. So first, you have to realize we're looking at a much lower level of punishment than the 30 years, 40 years, 50 years that some people are kind of throwing around as possibilities.
As John Schwartz pointed out, they always cite the maximum when they describe what might happen.
Yeah, which has absolutely nothing to do with what actually occurs at trial. So it's just important to realize that those numbers are an order of magnitude higher of the kind of realistic sentence we would have been talking about. But as to whether the prosecutors kind of went too far, I think some criminal punishment was appropriate. Here's an individual who was going on the MIT campus, not a member of the MIT community, using their network. The MIT system administrators tried to ban him from doing what he was doing. He kept circumventing the ban, eventually broke into a closet in order to circumvent the ban from the wireless network, was trying to download several million articles, some of which, many of which, are copyrighted articles. The apparent plan was to put those on online file sharing networks. I don't think we'd want to say, hey, that's great. It's not your database. It's copyright protected, but go ahead, break into the closet. Anyone can do that. I don't think we'd want to say that that shouldn't be a crime at all, and in fact, it is a crime and a felony under federal law. I think the real debate is how serious a crime was it, and it depends, I think, in part on what you think about academic articles and whether you think it's a good thing, ultimately, that those are available, would be available on file-sharing networks, or whether you take the view that this is not a public database. This is something that was largely copyright protected, or at least in part copyright protected. And what's difficult about this from a legal standpoint is that the scale of what Schwartz was doing was truly massive. He was accessing millions of articles, academic articles, from, I believe, over 1,000 journals. So this is very wide-scale conduct, and you know, it's very easy. I think we'd all agree that it's a very low-level offense if it's only a small number of articles or just only a little bit of data. What's tricky is once you get into the millions of articles range, while it's true that no one was directly harmed as a result of what happened beyond relatively minor network problems, for example, over a small period of time, what Schwartz had planned was something that arguably would have harmed some people pretty significantly because some copyrighted documents that people had a right to control, they'd no longer be able to control. So there's I think, reasonable room for disagreement on this issue of whether the prosecutors went too far.
John Schwartz, before we lose you, I know you need to leave us very soon and we need to go to a break. This has become a real cause célèbre on the Internet and amongst people who are of the Internet generation.
Well, yes. There's something inherently tragic about a gifted 26-year-old ending his life, and that has really gripped people. But beyond that, the people who knew Aaron, who had been following him, the utter awfulness of it, it led to a kind of internet grieving. It's a group grieving. You could 140 characters is not a lot to be able to express grief. But listen to what Tim Berners-Lee, who helped create the World Wide Web, had to say about it. He issued a tweet that said, "Aaron dead, world wanderers, we have lost a wise elder. Hackers for right, we are one down. Parents all, we have lost a child. Let us weep."
John Schwartz, again, former legal and science reporter of the New York Times, now diplomatic correspondent. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Pleasure.
We're going to continue the conversation with our other guests and others. We'll also hear from the campus at MIT. On Reporter's Notebook later, New York has become the first state to increase gun control in the aftermath of the Newtown, Connecticut massacre. We'll hear about that back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about Aaron Schwartz, recognized by the world as a computer wizard at the age of 14, contributed software we're still using today, committed suicide last week at the age of 26, someone who suffered from depression, but who also was under very serious indictment by the federal government for actions that he took at MIT in particular, where he broke into a closet in order to manipulate the internet in such a way as to free up documents that were under copyright to millions and millions of documents, as we have heard. The president of MIT has launched an investigation into what happened, how the university handled the matter. Ethan Solomon is executive editor at the MIT Tech newspaper. Ethan Solomon, good to have you on our program.
Hi, good to be here.
Tell us how this is being regarded on the campus itself, which, of course, is a place where techies get their education.
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, people are definitely talking about it, more so than many events in the past year that I've witnessed. You know, people talking around lunch tables, and as you might imagine, there's a diversity of opinion. But as you also might guess, there's a strong culture here among students and faculty, and that culture is very much in alignment with Aaron Swartz's ideals, which your prior commentators talked about at length, mainly those ideals being kind of open access and free access to information online, in particular information that was supported by taxpayer dollars. So, you know, certainly making the rounds on social networks, in Facebook and Twitter, from MIT students. As you might guess, you know, MIT is the exact kind of place that would react strongly to a death of someone like Aaron Swartz.
Okay. How does the reaction to the behavior of the administration with regard to this case? I know that there are those outside the university who are saying that the MIT administration could have done more to perhaps mitigate the kind of charges that he was subject to by the federal government.
That's right. There's a lot of people saying that. And the thing I want to maybe start out with is saying that there's a lot that's also unknown about exactly how involved MIT was in the prosecution of Aaron Swartz. And to some extent, you can say MIT isn't even really sure. You mentioned Raphael Reif's statement on the matter, President Raphael Reif, who appointed an MIT computer scientist, Hal Abelson, to lead the analysis of what decisions were made and how the process was handled by MIT's administration. A lot of people have reacted positively to Abelson's pick. He's a respected senior professor here at MIT. He was a founding member of Creative Commons. He teaches a technology and ethics course. He's sort of the kind of person that you would actually expect to be kind of off the bat aligned with what Aaron Swartz might have believed and might have been working towards. So people have praised that particular pick. As far as kind of the outside reaction to what MIT has done, I'll say those are the questions that, you know, at my newspaper, those are the questions we're asking. We're trying to figure out what role MIT played in the prosecution. For its own part, right now, the MIT administration isn't really saying anything, and they're saying that they're making no comment out of respect for Aaron's family, and also acknowledging that they want to let Professor Abelson carry out his investigation or analysis, as MIT calls it, before they make any official comment. I also actually want to point out that I forgot to mention in your earlier question, there's a petition that some MIT students have started. It's a petition for MIT to apologize. And what they mean by apologize is apologize for not saying anything to stop the prosecution. And that petition, within less than 24 hours, appears to have around 216 signatures, last I checked. Not guaranteed they're all from MIT students, but that seems like a reasonably impressive rate. So again, there's a lot of unknowns.
Again, let me point out to our listeners, we invited the U.S. attorney in Boston, who's taken a lot of heat for this, the one who decided to prosecute Aaron Swartz for so many crimes, including fraud, wire fraud, illegal obtaining of information, breaking into the wire closet. She declined, however, to participate in our program. And Ethan Solomon at the Tech newspaper, I take it that somebody claiming to be involved with the hackers group Anonymous did attack the MIT system. Is that correct? Has that caused a lot of problems on campus?
That is correct. I won't say it caused a lot of problems. It was an interesting night on Sunday evening for about 3 hours. Between roughly 7 and 10 p.m., no one on campus could access most of the internet. People were a little confused as to what was going on. Initially, it was thought that this was sort of a network problem that was, you know, totally internal. We had actually had network problems about a week earlier, and those were totally unrelated to Aaron Swartz. But it later became apparent that it, in fact, was the result of a denial of service attack on MIT's network, which the hacking group Anonymous basically essentially took credit for when they posted on two MIT subdomains, at least two MIT subdomains, a rather lengthy message outlining what they believe to be an injustice against Aaron Swartz and what they also think should be the future of information on the Internet.
Ethan Solomon again, executive editor at the MIT Tech newspaper. Oren Kerr, back to you, professor of law, George Washington School of Law. What about the nature, the state of the law in this context? You said earlier that when you get into millions of documents, then maybe you're causing a problem and doing some harm. But those alleged to have been harmed in this situation didn't want to prosecute, apparently. And one wonders, does the law need to be updated? The Internet changes very rapidly, and the laws, as I understand it, are 20 years old.
Yeah, this is an area of law that I think really does need reform in a number of different ways. So first of all, the law was written to deal with the value of information obtained, the thinking of if somebody commits an unauthorized access and then obtains valuable information, that that's an important harm. That's one of the reasons why the charges against Swartz were severe as they are. We might say, wait a minute, how severe were these facts, actually? Maybe somebody can obtain information that's worth significantly more than the current $5,000 threshold and still not be someone who deserves serious criminal punishment. So we're all comfortable with physical world criminal laws like homicides and theft and burglary, and we know how they apply, and those have been around for a long time. We've just started to deal with this question of what digital crimes should look like, and we have criminal statutes that are on the books from about 20 years ago. 1986 was the one of the major years in which a lot of the federal statute was introduced, and we still haven't thought through what kinds of conduct should we punish, and how severely should we punish that conduct? What is a serious computer crime? What is a less serious computer crime? Should we focus on intent to harm? Should we focus on intent to obtain money from it, sort of to make a buck off of the unauthorized access? And we just need to have a public conversation about what kind of conduct online should be criminal, and what kind of conduct should be treated as a serious crime worthy of jail time, and what should be treated as just as a minor crime.
What about the issue of the fact that in all of these cases involving Aaron Swartz, the information involved was initially generated at taxpayer expense, and the claim is made then that every taxpayer ought to have access to that since they paid for it?
Well, I'm not sure that's the case factually. So my understanding is that the JSTOR database has 1,000 journals. So those different journals would have originated in different ways under different circumstances. I don't think we can say one size fits all as to how they were created.
But should that make a difference then, if in fact the document involved was created at government expense? Should the law take account of that?
Well, perhaps. And I think more importantly, there's an important distinction. We might say there's a certain database that we think the public should have access to. But if we think that the way to achieve that is to have Congress legislate that the database should be open, the right way is not to go in there, break in, grab the documents, and then release them on a file-sharing network. We have laws that are designed to set the rules of society, and you can't just sort of do what you think is right and then say, hey, I hope that will work for everyone. Now, I'm not saying it should be a serious crime, but it's not something that we would want anyone to be able to do. I mean, maybe somebody thinks that medical records are something that should be public. We would not want people taking the law into their own hands, and so we should have two different conversations. One is what kind of documents should be public, and we should sort of reach a societal a view of that through the law, and then the other is what kind of conduct to get documents or to get information should be criminalized. And I think those are two different questions.
Oren Kerr, again, professor of law, George Washington School of Law, author of Computer Crime Law. Good to have you on our program. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to go back to Susan Crawford again, who's now professor at the Cardozo School of Law in New York, served in the Obama administration as a technology advisor. She's author of Captive Audience, the Telecom Industry, and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. What about the claims, Ms. Crawford, that what Aaron Swartz really was prosecuted for was challenging the authority of the government and the companies involved in taking these documents and making them inaccessible except at cost? Do you buy that?
Well, I want to align myself with my colleague, Professor Kerr, and his support for the rule of law. What Aaron did was to download millions of documents. The scale of this was quite impressive. And so the scale of it, taken in concert with the potential damages available in this area, gave the prosecution a lot of discretion. Now, for whatever reason...
What's the potential damage if the if JSTOR, for example, which was supposed to have been damaged the most, didn't want to see him prosecuted?
I mean damages from the government's perspective, damages they could ask the trial court for. So within, you know, as we've said, $1 million potentially or 35 years in jail was available to the prosecution as a requested penalty. And in this final plea agreement, they were asking for, we think, 6 months and much reduced monetary penalties. So there was a great deal of discretion given to the prosecution. I don't know what rationale caused them to go ahead with this. They have a lot of choices in who they decide to go after. Aaron may have tweaked them one too many times. I can't tell. Oren is right that this was not necessarily government-produced information not covered by copyright, but these were many varieties of journal articles, all probably under copyright, and for which someone is charging. So, again, we keep asking about proportionality. I think we're going to have to see if the prosecutor ever decides to talk about this. The eventual plea agreement offered to Aaron was pretty slight, but we understand that he didn't want to undergo jail time of any kind. And I can understand that for a guy who suffers from depression and is afraid of his loss of freedom, who takes freedom as his most important value. That would have a really crushing, crushing effect.
What's your take on Internet freedom, and should it be as unlimited as possible?
Well, I have a story about Aaron. I remember when he was 19, attending a meeting, I was also there, of a bunch of telecommunications experts from around the world. And Aaron stood up at the very end, and he'd said very little, and we were waiting for him to talk because he's such a prodigy. And he said that he was very surprised to learn that the U.S. might not necessarily develop advanced communications infrastructure that would be necessary to support all the things that he and his colleagues were busily writing. They had all assumed, he and his generation had assumed, that users of the Internet would have open and affordable access to all the bandwidth they might need. And this was a sobering moment for all of us older people in the room, because Aaron was committed, and his generation is committed, to the ability to access information. Now, not all of that information will be available for free, but at least you can find it. And the constraint on bandwidth, and from my perspective, the control of local cable monopolies on wired access, is a real problem for the country. And so Aaron is really part of this meta theme of the flow of information and its importance around the world. This last episode in his life, I think, doesn't accurately reflect the rest of the themes that he was really pushing for: lots of access, lots of bandwidth, and lots of easy ability for individuals to publish what they cared about.
I take it in other countries, South Korea, for example, there's much more freedom of access than there is here.
Right, and I don't mean access for free. Everybody pays, but if you get an apartment in Seoul, right now you get a choice of 3 fiber providers, and it's about $30 a month. And that's 100 megabits symmetrical upload and download. That's unthinkable in America today, those kinds of prices and that kind of speed. And Aaron was really struck by that the U.S. seemed to have no path towards getting to where a place like South Korea or Japan will be.
Quickly back to Ethan Solomon, executive editor at the MIT Tech newspaper. You are of the same generation, presumably, that Susan Crawford is talking about. Do you see this, and do others at MIT see this as a generational issue?
Well, I think they do, to the extent that people in certain generations are aware of how other generations feel, and it's always hard to put yourself in someone else's shoes. But I think that my generation and Aaron's generation certainly feel that way, and I'm similarly struck by the facts that were just mentioned, the fact that the United States is one of the, you know, it lags much of the rest of the world in terms of the speed and availability and the cost of Internet access. Certainly MIT students in particular don't need to worry about that quite as much, because MIT has put a decent amount of effort into making sure it has an advanced network infrastructure that can provide large volumes of data very quickly. But no, I mean, I think you'd find that most people at MIT, certainly, and even outside of MIT, would very much agree with Aaron's idea of making information at least more accessible.
Professor Crawford, in addition to the monopolies that now control Internet access in most American neighborhoods, what other limitations are there on Internet freedom?
Well, I think access is one of the most important limitations. We also have deeply vertically integrated carriers, particularly Comcast in America. That means they also own programming. Comcast owns NBCU. And so they have a built-in conflict of interest to favor their own material. AT&T is talking about toll-free applications that would reach smartphone users for free, so Facebook would pay a fee to AT&T to reach those users. And then whatever the users did using Facebook wouldn't be subject to a cap on their activities. This actually allows the carriers to make a lot of money off of discriminating between open Internet applications, new kinds of things like the stuff that Aaron and his friends were building, and their own quasi-proprietary material online.
So there's a lot of issues then to be dealt with. Is there any indication, you were in the Obama administration, that either executive agencies or the Congress might take these up?
I'm quite hopeful that in the second term of the Obama administration, there'll be a much greater focus on technology policy. This is something that certainly bugged Aaron. He was always wondering why the administration wasn't leaping into these issues with more vigor. And, you know, but the Obama administration had to worry about the banks and health care and the country sliding into an abyss at the beginning of 2009. And now with the air a bit clear, I'm hoping that they'll be focusing a great deal on exactly this kind of issue.
So you think then that the administration you served ought to get off its its current position and make some changes?
Well, they're going to need all of us to help them because the actors, the incumbents in this area, have so much political power. They're so well plugged in. AT&T gives more money to politics than Goldman Sachs. And they have employees in every congressional district. So in order to help our elected officials and our regulators get a handle on these sorts of situations, we'll need to make sure that they feel politically protected, that they'll be reelected. As a matter of foreign policy, the U.S. does very well talking about the importance of open access and an open Internet because we understand fundamentally that the Internet is democracy. It allows everybody to publish and to speak back to power. We're not quite as good on this front domestically.
Susan Crawford again, professor at the Cardozo School of Law, formerly with the Obama administration, and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age, something I take it that Aaron Swartz all understood very well, the late Aaron Swartz. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks to Ethan Solomon, the executive editor of the MIT Tech newspaper, Orrin Kerr, professor of law, George Washington School of Law, our earlier guest, and also John Schwartz, who was with us from the New York Times. Good to have all of you, and many thanks. Thanks to you. In the aftermath of the Newtown, Connecticut massacre, President Obama is scheduled to propose new gun controls tomorrow. But today, New York is on the verge of becoming the first state to act since that atrocity. We'll be back in a moment with To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Last night, New York's Republican-controlled state Senate approved new gun controls by a vote of 43-18. Today, the Assembly, led by Democrats, is expected to go along. Debate is going on as we speak. Governor Cuomo is reportedly ready to sign as soon as the measure passes, which is what is expected to happen. Thomas Kaplan is political reporter in Albany for the New York Times. Thomas Kaplan, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's the nature of these new gun controls?
Well, it's a broad package that touches on a number of things. The centerpiece of it is an expanded ban on assault weapons. New York already has a ban, but this would close loopholes in the ban and include more weapons under it. It also would expand New York's ban on high-capacity magazines. Under the new law, the maximum number of rounds that could be held in the magazine would be 7, which would be the lowest in the country. There are a number of other provisions increasing mental health reporting for background checks, requiring background checks for ammunition purchases, creating new gun licensing standards, and also tougher penalties for gun crime. So it's quite a broad package.
Tell us about the politics of the New York Senate and Assembly.
Well, the traditional way this has worked is the Assembly has a large Democratic majority and has tried to pass new gun control laws almost every year. But the Senate has historically been controlled by Republicans who have been resistant to new gun laws. Many of the Republicans come from upstate New York, where there are a large number of gun owners, hunters, sportsmen, and that's been sort of a traditionally defining issue for them, blocking new gun laws. However, the Republicans have lost seats in the Senate over the years, and this year they actually only have partial control of the chamber, along with a small number of Democrats who act as sort of an independent faction within the broader Democrats within the Senate. They have pushed for gun control, so that added kind of a new element to the dynamic this year. And in fact, the leader of those independent Democrats was the sponsor in the Senate of the gun control package last night.
So what are you hearing then as the debate goes on in the Assembly? And are arguments generated by the NRA, for example, being heard by, are they being voiced by some?
Some of the rhetoric is similar. You get arguments on a number of grounds, certainly a constitutional argument from lawmakers who argue that essentially these restrictions infringe upon the Second Amendment. You have arguments that they don't really get at the problem of gun violence, that they would punish law-abiding New Yorkers who are not doing anything wrong, while maybe not getting at mentally ill people who are, you know, the ones who may commit these mass shootings. But the debate here, it's different from last night in the Senate. There was almost no debate, and most of the senators who opposed the measure did not speak. The Assembly debate has now gone on for more than 3 hours, even though there's not seen as any risk that the measure would fail, given the large Democratic majority in the Assembly.
Let me ask you some specifics about the laws. When you expand the ban on assault weapons and high capacity, set lower limits on high capacity magazines, what do you do under these new proposals with those that are already out there?
Well, that was one of the controversial things and one of the last things to be negotiated here. For folks who already have weapons that would be considered assault weapons under the new law, they'll have a year to register those weapons with the state. They can keep them, but there'll be a database of them and they'll need to register. That was controversial. A lot of folks have objected to that. There was even talk and fear of having to turn those guns in. Governor Cuomo at one point used the word confiscation, and that set off a lot of fear among gun owners. So that's the plan there. With the magazines, that's another tough issue. One provision in the law actually would allow people with 10-round magazines to keep them, but you could only load 7 rounds into them. Some critics of this measure have said, well, how in the world would you ever enforce that?
I understand that in order to get some of the Republicans on board, or to at least to allow this to take place, that there were there was language involving the publishing of the names of permit holders, something that one Westchester County newspaper apparently recently did.
Yes, that became a part of it. There's been a whole controversy over folks who have pistol permits and that information being public record. And in this law, it would provide a mechanism for gun owners to opt out of having their pistol permit be a public record to avoid that situation repeating itself. And that was a critical thing that some Republicans pushed for as part of this package. And it certainly came about because of, or certainly was amplified by, the publication of the pistol permits in 2 counties in the New York City area.
Has there been a big increase in gun sales in New York as this measure has been under consideration?
It's hard to say. Anecdotally, it appears so. There was a report this morning from an Albany area gun shop that showed, you know, people streaming in and out and a lot of cars in the parking lot. It certainly seems that that is the case. And I went a couple days ago to the Buffalo area to interview gun owners who were concerned about these measures as they were being debated. And that certainly was something people were saying, is, you know, time to buy what you want now before it could be outlawed in a couple days.
What's the concern in New York about the measures that the president is talking about revealing tomorrow? We have some idea of what that is going to involve. And is there debate going on now in the assembly about how federal law might affect the state?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that people have said all along, including Governor Cuomo, is that federal action is most important here because New York can only deal with what happens within its borders. And, for instance, in the assembly debate, actually, someone who opposed the law asked, well, can't I just drive 50 miles to Pennsylvania, buy my ammunition there, and not have to go through a background check? And one of the sponsors of the bill who was defending it had to admit, well, yeah, you could do that. So that's kind of the issue. New York can only deal with New York. And there has not been a lot of focus on the federal talks, I think in part because it's been such a whirlwind developing the New York proposal. But certainly all along, all of the advocates of further gun control have said, we're going to do what we can and we'll hopefully set an example for other states. But the most important thing is for Congress to tackle this issue.
And Governor Cuomo has been supporting this. So, of course, has Mayor Bloomberg of the city of New York.
Yes. Mayor Bloomberg has made this a national issue dating back years, and he is very supportive, said today was, you know, very praising of the action in Albany.
Okay. All right. To Thomas Kaplan again, a political reporter for the New York Times, waiting to see the Assembly of the State of New York very likely pass these new gun controls and the governor sign them into law before the end of the day. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much.
Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Evan George and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.